Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona. Now I want to thank you for tuning in this evening to the Hour of the Time, and you can thank yourself for what you're about to learn. We're going to do another blast from the past, if you will, this evening. I'll give you some current commentary, and then I'm going to play a recording that is old. Now, old in the sense of how most radio talk show hosts do research. Although, to many of us, many of my friends, family, 1956 wasn't that long ago. So I think many of you out there can appreciate this recording. And it's very telling again, just like the other broadcast I've been doing, that the situation has built and built and built up over time to become more and more extreme of the taking of our freedoms. And if you do not understand the foundations, the history, you cannot logically defeat the enemy. That would be world socialism, world government, world religion. You cannot stop that force unless you understand their background, their modes of operation, their agendas. And the only way you can do that is through research that you can document and verify through multiple sources. Like only us here at the Hour of the Time. We're not just going to tell you the newest thing we got in the email from somebody who saw their cousin, who then talked to their friend, whose secretary was driving down the street and saw a UN convoy. But their camera cell phone didn't work at the time and da-da-da-da. That's the predominant method of spreading information around the internet nowadays and many of the talk shows. And it's utter crap. So let's get to the facts. The facts are scary enough, ladies and gentlemen. We don't have to make anything up. Maybe it makes you feel better if you do that. But you'd feel a lot better if you just did your research. Check out what we're saying. Verify it if you don't believe us. I want you to. I dare you to. Try to prove us wrong. And by doing that, you'll feel just as good. And you'll know the truth, not a bunch of idiot forwarded emails or propaganda put out there by Agent Provocateur, talk show host. Now, the reason in this case why this blast from the past from 1956 is so pertinent is because it's a different type of immigrant coming to this country. These immigrants were freedom fighters. In Hungarian freedom fighters, and they were utterly betrayed by the people, including the United States, that said we would back them up. They were led to the slaughter. British and American intelligence agents told the Russians the day before their big stand, which we had prompted and helped them plan, all of their plans and times and field strength numbers and locations. And they were utterly butchered by the communist machine. But some of them escaped, willing to risk everything to get here for freedom. A different type of immigrant than we see today. These didn't have their hands out. They appreciate freedom and fought for it. And when you listen to this old recording, I want you to take note of how they say Hungary, who is a wonderful, flourishing society, prosperous, free, how quickly, right in front of their own eyes, It was taken over through socialist and communist propaganda, and a dictatorship was invoked all within about a 10-year period. When you listen to the methods employed by the world government crowd, world socialists, the butchers, the tyrannical leaders, to enslave their country, and look at what's going on today in this country, it's a mirror image, ladies and gentlemen. Now I'll give you a little background here. Here's a special bulletin to all wire services and news agencies, July 13th, 1956, Ingolstadt, West Germany. 2 hours ago, an unusual event took place at the military air force base near Ingolstadt. An emergency landing of a Soviet-Hungarian airliner was made. As the plane came to a stop, a man staggered out of the plane and walked around slowly. Then others were emerging, some on their own feet, some being carried out on makeshift stretchers. Most of them blood-stained, some unconscious. An hour later, in the small local hospital, the most fantastic story in modern day's history was unveiled, which has likely become one of the most fascinating headline stories of the year. 7 young Hungarians, 6 men and 1 woman, most of them at this moment on the operating table in the hospital, hijacked that airliner a few hours ago over Hungary. Their purpose? To escape from their communist-terrorized homeland. A desperate struggle succeeded in overcoming the armed secret policeman and the resisting crew of 4. The man leading the team and the heroic flight took control of the plane when the ground was only a few hundred feet away, flew from Soviet Hungary, and landed here in Ingolstadt, Germany. Now, Frank Izak, born in Hungary in 1931, was educated in parochial elementary and high school, and attended the University of Chemical Engineering of Hungary between 1951 and 1956. During that period, he had worked for various communist newspapers where he saw the communist apparatus working at full speed. The conditions in Hungary became unbearable, but the Iron Curtain was completely sealed off, making any escape attempt a suicide. Frank Izak and his wife and 5 friends worked out and succeeded in a never-before-attempted plan to hijack a commercial airliner in flight. After his escape, he received political asylum in West Germany, where he worked for the United States government for over 4 years. He immigrated to the United States in 1957 and worked for 6 years as a research chemist in Berkeley, California. Then for over 2 years, he was employed by a San Francisco Bay Area newspaper. In 1963, he obtained his American citizenship, and a year later was awarded the citation, the Most Outstanding American of the Year, by the American Legion Auxiliary of California. He was an author, a lecturer, and a debater. He traveled extensively over the United States telling his story with no mercy, the story of Hungary and the degradation of life behind the barbed wire. As a man who actually lived and experienced communism and then tasted freedom of the free world, his message can be summed up in one sentence. Love America and protect her because she is the last hope of mankind.
The day was July the 13th, 1956. It was a Friday. At early afternoon, one of the Russian radar operators, those controlling the Hungarian air territory, noticed a very strange phenomenon. A commercial airliner on a routine flight from one Hungarian city to another all of a sudden disappeared from the radarscope. The plane answered no calling signals, and the Russian jet fighters who were sent to find this plane discovered no trace of it. It had become a mystery, which grew until 7 p.m. of the day. The first one to report was a West German radio station in a special bulletin that a Soviet-Hungarian airliner made an unscheduled landing at a NATO Air Force base near Ingolstadt, Germany. Most of the passengers been hospitalized in serious condition. Those were the first words. And with this beginning, the most fantastic story in the history of aviation unveiled, hitting the front page of every newspaper around the world, being written up in every major magazine and broadcasted by every television network around the world. This airliner was hijacked in flight over Hungarian territory in the most dramatic mid-air struggle. I was a member of that hijacking team, and here is what happened. We boarded the plane in Budapest. Its destination was another Hungarian city near to the Iron Curtain. Our aim and determination was that the plane never will land in Hungary. Our aim was to take over the control, but we knew that among the passengers there is a well-armed secret policeman. His identity was unknown to us. Our plan was to knock down and knock unconscious every passenger, hoping that the secret policeman is among them, and disarm him, take his gun, break into the pilot cabin, and force the crew at gunpoint to give up the control. 20 minutes before landing time, we moved into action. The airplane was flying at 10,000 feet, quietly. Most of the passengers were peacefully reading their papers when we struck. Within seconds, 14 passengers were knocked out of their seat, and most of them were lying unconsciously on the floor of the cabin. We were ready to make the next move into the pilot cabin. But then, all of a sudden, something unexpected happened. The door between the cockpit and the passenger cabin opened up. Somebody peeked out. Then, before we knew, I was shot. And the next moment, I knew that it is the end. The huge plane went into a deep dive. The inside of that cabin became somewhat like a spaceship. As the plane was tumbling down with an accelerated speed, people, luggage, seats came loose and began to float. Now, all of a sudden, the plane turned upward sharply. Everybody and everything hit the floor like a shot bird. For a moment, there was a crawling, moaning, bleeding, agonizing, pitching on the floor, and the circle started all over again. The plane was going into another deep dive. For one moment, I saw George. He was prying the door of the cockpit with a screwdriver. George was the leader of our team. Then everything started to spin around me. I tried to move. I tried to go forward to help George, but everything went black. When I came to, the plane was still tumbling. George already broke into the pilot cabin, where he found the man we knocked down 14 passengers for, the secret policeman. He had the loaded gun in his hand. His fingers were on the trigger, ready to kill. But then a hand, much stronger than that of the secret policeman, much stronger than any human hand ever can be, reached there and said, "No." That was the hand of God. The gun misfired, George jumped the secret policeman, and there a fight for life and death began. For long, desperate moments, George could get no help from the rest of our team. By the time we were able to move forward, he was bleeding from more than a dozen open wounds, and most of us was lying with broken legs, arms, or cracked heads. The plane was approaching a cornfield, ready to make an emergency landing. The earth seemed to rush toward us with a tremendous speed. The land down there, just a few hundred feet away, it was still the land of darkness and slavery. Our homeland, Hungary, and only seconds away. 4 hours later, our journey came to its end. Ironic it may sound, but after the plane landed, we lived through moments which were tenser and more fearful than those during the desperate and hopeless struggle we had aboard the plane over Hungary. This is what happened. After flying across the Iron Curtain, we have decided not to land in the neighboring Austria, but keep on flying to western Germany, several hundred miles west. Well, we had no maps, we had no navigation, and then at one point we had no more fuel either. At 6 p.m. the plane touched down on the runway of an empty airport, and none of us really knew what country it was. Without navigation, we could have strayed over any country. It could have been at either side of the Iron Curtain. The plane came to a stop. I was one of the first to climb out. The airport was empty and completely deserted. We began to unload the plane. The tension in our hearts was growing into an immense fear. What country is this? Then, just as an answer to our question, from the end of the airport came a car. As it was coming closer and closer, the moments were almost unbearable. My heart was going wild, beating like a drum. My knees were trembling. There was a tremendous silence all of a sudden all around us. And in this deep, frightening silence, the car was driving up. It felt like that an eternity has fallen on us. Then all I can remember, that I was on my knees. I didn't know how I got there, but I was kneeling on the concrete in the dust, and tears were pouring down on my face. I don't know when it started. But they were tears with a taste I never had before. Joy and happiness. The car was already there, and through my tears I looked at it again. Yes, it was true. Blown by a gentle wind, and the aerial of the car, there it was. The flag with the stars and stripes. I couldn't take my eyes off anymore. Some wonderful, unexplainable feeling was rushing through my body, through my bones, through my bloodstream. It was something like a chill. It was something like a cold shiver, yet it was something wonderful. A feeling I never had before and never since. It was a physical joy of experiencing freedom for the first time in my life. It was a physical joy of understanding and feeling freedom for the first time. After spending a quarter of a century in darkness and in slavery. For me, darkness and slavery ended. But this darkness didn't start out as such. It started out as a dream back in 1945. And not only for me, but for 9 million Hungarians who were left behind by a terrible war, by fascism, Nazism, and all of that destruction. When April 1945 the war ended, our people understood that there is a job to do, to rebuild the destruction-torn land. Our main concern became how to rebuild the country and how to create a better life for our people. Politics, it wasn't our concern. Communism was even less. And the Hungarians wanted no part of communism. The Communist Party is less than a token force. They have less than 200 members. We are going to have free elections. We are going to have other political parties to choose from. We are going to have prosperity. Our churches are going to be open. We are going to have a better life. Communism, now it was no concern. The year was 1945. The year which marked the beginning of the dreams of 9 million Hungarians. The dreams, which ended less than 5 years later. 1949, the Communist Party of Hungary came into unrestricted and full power. And during those 5 years, we had free elections. We had other political parties to choose from. We had prosperity. As a matter of fact, prosperity was on the increase, and we never had it so good. And in the meantime, the occupying Soviet forces didn't even have to fire a single shot. And yet communism was there as a brute reality. What happened? You see, our nation had a history of 1,000 years. It might be true that we didn't enjoy freedom much, but if any nation had the desire to have freedom and any nation had the guts to fight for, we did. During those 1,000 years, We were the defense of Western Europe. We were the Far East outpost of Western civilization. We kept the barbarians who were coming from the East, the Turks, the Tatars, the Russians. And our nation kept fighting and kept bleeding while the rest of Western Europe prospered. Our history is and was an endless fight for freedom. An endless fight for freedom which we have never given up. And now, for the modern-day barbarians, it took only 5 years. And the light of that freedom which we fought for, which our fathers, forefathers died for, and which we cherished, was just blown out. What happened? You can ask again. The history of those years between 1945 and 49 is a terrifying one. We have been deceived. We have been deceived so tremendously. We thought that the criteria of the communist takeover are the firing squads, the machine guns, the concentration camps. And we felt that until we see these typical hallmarks of communism and totalitarianism, we don't have to worry. Then it was time to learn the very bitter lesson. 1949, we're dead. The first one was that communism never comes in and never takes power by using terror and bloodshed. It uses that only to stay in power. Communism, as every other totalitarian system, beginning with the popular things, like the land reform in 1945. With the promise of social reforms, by appropriating the land and redistributing the wealth of the country, by promising everybody a leisurely life, by promising everybody prosperity, and in the meantime creating an all-powerful government with the consent of the people to do all these very noble and humanly sounding things for them. And I remember when our people were giving and giving and giving more and more power to the government. Because after all, we believe that this thing should be done for us by our government. And as the government, which, mind it, was not a communist government, at least it wasn't on the surface, because then nobody would trust it, government was growing and growing. And as it was assuming more and more control over the life and the property of the people, simultaneously the Communist Party was assuming more and more power over the government, and consequently over the people. I was trained systematically by the communists to be a leader someday. I think I can speak with some authority on the communist strategy. And if I had to describe the most important field where the communists concentrated their effort and their deceptive methods to succeed the takeover, the most, I would describe this field with one word: government. I'm convinced that the major factor in our own enslavement was the fact that we, the Hungarian people, had a false attitude and a false concept and understanding what the government should be. Now, you see, it was our own government, our own lawfully elected so-called representative or coalition government, which had done the major job for the communists, which the communists themselves could never do, and this job has been done for them in the name of the people. It was a Hungarian non-communist coalition government, which in the early stage liquidated the truly anti-communist element. It was this government, this coalition government, which signed the death sentence of more fine Hungarian patriots, thousands of them, calling them fascists and Nazis and war criminals, while the true Nazis and the true war criminals and the true executioners were moving right into where they belonged to, the Communist Party. It was our government which established socialism there and destroyed the basic human rights, including the most important, or one of the most important ones, to own property. It was our own government which, under the false label of progress, was gravitating more and more to the left. And while on the scene it was just a socialist progressive government, behind the front, the most ruthless power in the political arena was already emerging to take command whenever the situation becomes ripe. The communists didn't have to destroy the moral fiber of our country. The leftists and the socialists have done the job for them. They were the ones who destroyed patriotism of our young people, who destroyed the respect for law and order, the belief in God, the individual responsibilities and rights. They were the ones who eliminated and ridiculed and forced out of our school the name of God, the love of country. And even though that more Hungarian kids received education than ever before, it wasn't an education anymore. It had become a training ground for the social revolution to come, which social revolution was to be led by us, the young and the brave generation. I was a high school student in those days, and I remember very clearly, practically, for every move they made. We were told that in this new social revolution, we are going to be the leaders, and this new kind of world is going to be the kind of world we, the young people, are going to make it. All we have to do is just to destroy the old, outdated, reactionary system first. Of course, we were eager to do it. We were idealists. We wanted to have a new life, a new land, and a new order. And at that point, nobody told us what Lenin said, quote, demoralize the life of the land, and the revolution is already won. You see, while in our everyday life, prosperity was on the increase, and the moral fiber was attacked and undermined and finally destroyed, and at the same time, simultaneously, the government level was centralization of the power which being stepped up. Then things came to its end. The coexisting, cooperating fellow travelers knew and realized what is going on by now, and after digging into the public treasury, assuring their leisurely days for the rest of their lives, began to escape from the country. One after the other of the coalition leaders, the so-called coalition leaders, whom we trusted and believed to be the leader of our country, elected leaders of ours, traveled to the Western European countries for conferences, never to return. Yes, the ship was sinking and the rats were leaving it. In 1949, August the 20th, the inevitable came. The first traditional stage of the communist plan, which they call the takeover, has been completed with a deadly accuracy. And this is what the communists call the establishment of the classless society. This is traditionally the second stage of communism. You see, the first stage, they are operating behind front organizations, and they're using deception as their main strategy. Then they get into power, and then the second stage, the establishment of the classless society, begins. The Iron Curtain went up, the minefields with the machine gun towers were erected, and behind the barbed wires, where 9 million Hungarians had a dream for 5 years, the land became that of the terror, tears, and blood. It had become a damned land. The first step by the Communist Party done was to outlaw every organization, civic, religious, political, or otherwise, Boy Scouts and Masons, and you name them. The second step was to liquidate the class alien elements. Comrade Revoy said, quote, rendering innocuous the agents of the imperialist and the class alien elements within is a necessary part of our work to establish the world of socialism. Since the communist revolution has been completed, there was no need for the fellow travelers anymore, so the Communist Party decided that they have to go. It was even ironic, but the first public execution was administered to Leslie Reich at October 15, 1949, less than 2 months after the communist took over. Leslie Reich was a communist himself, responsible for the establishment of the Hungarian secret police. But the line of those who followed him was an endless line. Darkness descended upon our land. Fear and terror became everybody's companion for 24 hours a day. And the land became a jungle of inhumanity, with scared, running human beings as the animals in it. The sole aim of human beings became how to survive. It had become a life with no mercy. I don't think that anybody with any kind of vocabulary can ever tell you the atrocities and the fear and the terror which was in our land. I have seen people in their age of 70, their age of 80, people who have never committed any crime in their life. I have seen them dragged into concentration camps because they were classified as class alien elements. And there they were now, working 12 hours a day, doing one of the most popular things in a concentration camp they've done, breaking rocks. And after 12 hours a day work, they were lined up in a long line to get their once a day meal, a hot boiling soup. The particular about was that it was served right into their bare palms. I have seen these people with their shaking hands and palms as they learned in their old days how to drink and how to eat hot boiling soup from their bare palms just to survive. Because the sole purpose of the human life became how to survive. 1952, less than 3 years after the Communist Party completed a takeover and was in full control of every facet of life, they decided to make the biggest step. And that was to socialize the agriculture and to take away every acre of privately owned land from the people, from the same people who were getting this land in 1945 with the help and with the slogan of the Communist Party, who said that this land belongs to you people and we the Communists are giving it to you and we the Communists are going to stay here and make it sure nobody takes it away from you. And that was the deception, because less than 7 years later the same Communist Party came and said that the land belongs to the state. And the Hungarian people were not willing to accept this, and there was almost a revolution in the making. The Communist Party Central Committee made a quick decision. The decision was that the Hungarian people have to learn a lesson. A lesson that the Communist Party means business. I went to the University of Chemical Engineering in that year, and that day I was home, my first vacation. My parents lived in a small village. It was the first night. And something around midnight woke me up. It was a very strange sound. I sat up in my bed. I looked around in the room, scared. I tried to reach over to my parents' bed. It was empty. I looked around in the room and my eyes got used to the darkness of it. I saw my father. He was at the window. He was peeking out from behind the edge of the curtain. Then I saw my mother. She was kneeling next to her bed and she was praying. Loud. In the meantime, I recognized a strange, indeed strange sound. It came from a truck. According to my knowledge, nobody had any kind of automobile in that village of 4,000 people. It was a silent spring night. It was pretty close. My mother's prayer went loud. She cried, "God, God," she said, "save us." Then all of a sudden, she dropped her voice, and a tremendous silence sat in the room. The truck arrived at the front of our home, and then it stopped. The engine was still running. We are listening in this dramatic silence. All we could hear was this slowly idling engine. Around and around it went. It was the most fearful sound I ever heard in my life. It came through the night, it came through the walls, it came through our mind. It was pounding in our heart, it was pounding in our brain, and it stayed there. It was 12 years ago, more than that, and I still can hear it. Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night and hear the truck idling endlessly. And we could hear some people crying and shouting, hear them yelling, the doors of the truck were banged, and then it moved on. And a strange, fearful sound finally disappeared in the distance. My father left the window, came back, he went to my mother, helped her up from the floor, and he said to her in a very quiet voice, "Mother, it's all right now. Let's go to sleep. The truck didn't stop here tonight." And these two people, who never ever committed any crime in their life, now in their old age, after spending a whole lifetime with hard physical labor, one of them is at the window watching the truck, and the other one is praying and hoping that the truck isn't going to come for them tonight. I learned what it was. It was the police truck. And it was ordered by the Communist Party of Hungary to go around. And the purpose and the aim was to pick up people at random. Just anybody. Just to bring in people to the police station and drag them away. Many of them never came back again. Just to teach the Hungarian people that the Communist Party means business. I escaped from that land in 1956 July by taking part in that well-planned hijacking. Those seven of us who were risking our life on that hot summer afternoon, we were not out to get publicity or achieve a world fame. No. It was simply that there was no other way to escape from Hungary. Any attempt to cross the Iron Curtain was a suicide. We were not heroes. We were just seven young, desperate people making a very simple decision. We preferred to die than live under communism anymore. I couldn't even say that our decision was something of an exceptional one. 3 months later, millions of other Hungarians from all walk of life made the same decision. The decision which began to shake the communist empire in their very foundations. In 1996 October, a revolution started in Hungary. And in that vast prison land behind the barbed wires, one of the slaves was rebelling. The Soviet troops were retreating, some of them were defecting, and a small but immensely brave nation showed to the trembling and vacillating Western world that the fearful, powerful communist empire is nothing but a hoax. The Hungarians were fighting for their freedom again, and for days they were free. For days the light of hope began to shine in the eyes of 100 million other slaves behind the Iron Curtain and in the other satellite states. And then the light was blown out. You know that story. The Hungarians went to die by the thousands. And those Hungarians, they were not fascists, they were not militant revolutionaries. Most of them were just kids. Most of them coming from all walk of life. Mostly from families who were much, much poorer than the poorest one of you. And thousands of them were just children, like your children. Innocent, bright-eyed kids with a whole life ahead of them. Here they would be called teenagers. And now on the streets of Budapest they were marching into their death. They were giving their life for freedom, which they have never been allowed to learn, which taste they never been allowed to have. They were young ones. Sometimes it took two of them to carry a rifle. It was too heavy for one. But no matter how young they were, the way they died, it was as brave men die, tall and straight. Many times people are asking me, why am I talking about the Hungary of 8 years ago? Don't I realize, they ask, that things have changed since 1956? Don't I realize that communism has mellowed since? that they are different now, that there is more bread and more freedom in Hungary today than ever before? These are the questions which are being fired at me many times, and I feel that they are legitimate questions. After all, we are being told practically every day from every possible source of our mass communication media that the conditions have changed in Hungary. So what is the truth? Well, first of all, I feel that there is a lot of truth to the fact that there were changes in Hungary in 1956. But we are not being told by the same sources who are telling about these changes. They are not telling about the reasons behind the changes, and I would like to take the opportunity here to say a few words. First of all, communism historically has various stages. The first stage is the takeover. The second stage is the elimination of the class alien elements. And the third stage, the final stage, is the consolidation of communism. And in Hungary, the first stage was between 45 and 49. The second was 49 to 1956. And today, communism is consolidated. In Hungary, today they're using different methods to accomplish the very same aim and the very same purpose. That is all. Today the communists have changed the methods because they don't need the firing squads anymore. The Hungarian people themselves take care of that. For every child born in Hungary, there are 3 or 4 abortions. The Hungarian people cannot afford to have children and a better life both. So they don't have children. The communists today don't have to close the churches. They simply is using it. They switched over from the atrocities to the peaceful methods of consolidating the darkest dictatorship and slavery ever known to mankind. And the foolish Western world applauds and says, now you see, after all, communism is still mellowing. The Western world, this foolish world of ours, cannot see that all it happened at the battlegrounds switch from Hungary to much more important territories. Hungary is not important anymore. It is in the communist orbit. It is a communist land with no freedom to her people. But a communist aim and a communist target and the battleground moved over. You see, the communists have a master plan to conquer the world. And I haven't heard yet, and I haven't seen yet, one communist leader who abandoned the final aim of communism, world conquest. See, what we're making here is the main mistake. We confuse communism with the communist strategy. The communist strategy is changing. Of course it does. All the time. That is the very essence of it. Communist strategy is immensely flexible. But this continuously changing strategy never loses sight of the final aim, world conquest. The basic premise of communism is that it has to conquer all or die. That so-called peaceful coexistence, which we are so overwhelmed with many times, is nothing else than a strategy designed to accomplish revolutionary aims with peaceful methods. I'd like to tell you that the final target of the communist conquest is you. Communism, which has started out less than 50 years ago with less than a handful of men, a fanatical conspiracy to conquer the world during that 50 years, it had become a way of life for over 1 billion people. And during that 50 or less than 50 years, it had become a way of death for many, many unaccounted innocent human beings. And it keeps coming closer and closer to us, and we're trying to dream it away, we're trying to negotiate it away, we're trying to hope communism away. We can't. We either stop communism or we are going to live under it. And please, don't you try to fool yourself. It isn't going to be your children. You're either going to stop communism or you are going to live in communism. And their target, again, is you. Those of you right here in this room, right here in this city, in this state, and right in this country of ours, the target is America, and the battleground is also here. So we are concentrating on what is going on in South Vietnam and what is going on in Berlin and in the other part of the world, while the real struggle is fought right here in America. You know, any elementary student of communism will tell you that the communists regard the internal destruction of the United States as an imperative prerequisite for the world domination. Today the struggle goes on for the conquest of the mind. Today the communists are spending probably as much money and effort to change and destroy the American way of life right here in America than they are spending in their wars and in their revolutionary conquest of the rest of the world. According to investigative bodies in our government, every day there are 3 warehouse load of communist propaganda arriving only to New York City alone. The aim? To change and destroy the American way of life, conquering the mind of the people. Maybe I should explain with a few words what do I mean by the American way of life. When I came to this country some 8 years ago, there were many things I wasn't used to. There were many things I didn't like or I didn't approve. Customs, habits. Those were different than the ones I grew up and I got used to over in Europe. Nevertheless, there were 2 things which were overwhelmingly clear. I couldn't deny the enormous wealth and prosperity here. And the unmatched personal freedom and liberty what the people had. I said 2 things. I should have said 1. But then, 8 years ago, I didn't know it. All I knew that overall this is a great country, this is a country of which I could only dream before. So I wanted to learn why is this country so different. I wanted to know not how many thousand miles of 4-lane highways we have, not how many automobiles per family we have, not what our daily calorie intake per capita is. I wanted to know more. I wanted to know more than the obvious conveniences of the modern living, more than the washing machines and the swimming pools and the electric razors and the pop-top beer bottles. I wanted to know what makes all these things possible. I wanted to know what makes America. I set out to learn it. I studied the history. I found it is a glorious one. I read what your forefathers had to say, whom God given foresight and wisdom very few people in history ever had. I read time after time the greatest document ever designed by man, the written contract between the people and of this land and their government, your Constitution. The Constitution which was formed not to give liberty to the people, but to guarantee the liberty. And as the time went on, and the more I studied, my whole picture became clearer and clearer every day. I realized that the reason is freedom. I realized that freedom is what creates wealth and prosperity. I understood what us Europeans couldn't understand and couldn't make to work in 1,000 years of our history. That the only thing man needs is to be free and then to be let alone. And then free man will and free man can accomplish practically everything. This is what I learned. This was probably the greatest lesson I ever had. But then the question still remained, how to make the man free? Probably this is the greatest question ever posed to human beings, and very few of our societies ever been able to give the answer. By reading the words of Woodrow Wilson, I felt I found the answer, and I like to read that to you. The history of liberty is the history of limitations of governmental power. When we resist, therefore, the concentration of power, we are resisting the processes of death. The concentration of power is what always precedes the destruction of human liberties. You listen to these words, and then you look around yourself and see what all the things we got today. You look around and you can see these unbelievable accomplishments which were done by man free from oppression. Man who was freed from the most ruthless oppressor throughout the history of mankind, a totalitarian government. You look around and you'll find that the 5% or less than 5% of the world's population on less than 7% of the earth's territory produces more wealth than the rest of the world together. You look around and you'll find that the freedom of the individual in this land of ours is higher than in any other land, than in any other time in history known to any other society. You look around and you will find what the American way of life created for us. The American way of life which had become the target of the communist destruction. Well, people say, then if things are so good and the American way of life is so successful, then why are you ringing the alarm bell? What makes you worry? I mentioned earlier that the Soviet propaganda is coming in from various communist lands and by 3 warehouse load a day. And yet, this communist propaganda concerns me not. There is a far greater danger that worries me. You know, since I'm reading English, and that is about 7 or 6 or 7 years, I have read practically every issue of every major magazine published in the United States. I read Look, Life, Saturday Evening Post, Time, Newsweek, Playboy, you name it. However, I don't recall that any of those magazines have ever published a true account of the danger of communism, the tactic of communism, the strategy of communism, and what our life would be under communism. Not even one true expose why the Reds are winning, how their front organizations are paving the way for the communist takeover right here, how they are exploiting every possible movement, conflict, problem for their own ultimate aim of conquest. In 6 years, I have not read one. Did you? And if you didn't, have you ever asked the question, why not? And this is what worries me. You know, the Soviets have a scientific plan to enslave the world, and they follow it with a terrific preciseness and accuracy. Yet, even in this late and seemingly hopeless stage of the game, it frightens me not. There is something else what worries me. And it is the unbelievable complacency from the part of the people, the American people, who have the most to lose. What worries me is that we are incapable, or maybe unwilling, to understand that we cannot stop communism by throwing millions and billions of dollars around, presuming that the enemy is poverty and communism is the result of poverty. No, the enemy is communism. And we cannot fight the one in Peking and support the other one in Moscow. We cannot fight the one in Hanoi and support the other one in North Africa or in the Middle East or in the Eastern European states. And we still expect to win. No, we can't do that. The enemy is communism. Period. You know, on every November the 7th, which is the anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, the Red Army is parading its latest ICBM missiles and its superb military power and its destructive capability and might. Yet, the wire photos arriving from this impressive parade frightens me not. There is another parade which is much more frightful. The one which is being carried out some weeks ago at the campuses of one of our great institutes of higher learning, the University of California in Berkeley, when those who are going to be the leaders of our tomorrows were marching and proving their braveness by parading with a four-letter word, a young and a brave generation on the march. And then the word got around that if there is any reprisal against these brave students with their dirty words being carried around, then some of our Nobel Prize winner professors will resign in protest. In protest of what? That there are still some old-fashioned Americans who are not willing to equate degeneration, filth, uncouthness, anarchy with academic freedom? This is what frightens me. We got the word, and it's time even the pictures that the Soviet astronauts, or a Soviet astronaut leaped outside of his spaceship, and by doing that, was giving the Soviet Union another first in space age achievements. This bothered me not. There were far greater things to worry us. You take a closer look at our education today, with a respectable exception, and you will find that our education has kept shifting continuously from academic education to a training program for the coming social revolution. There are powerful forces at work today. All you have to do is open your eyes and see. Powerful forces which are trying to fulfill Lenin's request. And he said, give me the mind of the youth and I win the revolution. There are powerful forces at work to prepare America for the social revolution, and the idealism and the eagerness of our youth has never been more exploited for destructive purposes, to destroy the old system. Our youth is being prepared to lead the coming social revolution, which will sweep America away. America, the country which has been the land of the free and the home of the brave. And what will be left after then, I'm sure that you and I won't want to live in. But neither will those who are so diligently working today to bring it about. You know what worries me is to see our college graduates who don't know anything anymore about Patrick Henry, who don't know what the free enterprise is, who don't know how it operates, who don't know what the difference between democracy and a republic, who don't know what a constitutional government means, and they not only don't know, but they couldn't care less. Go ahead. And if you want to find out what should make you to worry also, go ahead and compare the rigid and the almost Puritan society in the Soviet Union where those 10, 12-year-old pioneer kids regard their pioneer button as the most valuable asset in their young life. Go ahead and compare that with some of our own teenagers, the glue sniffing, the marijuana smoking, the pornography promoting, flag ridiculing young people whose highest level of intellectuality doesn't extend beyond the worshipping of the Beatles, and whose high-end accomplishment is how to look more uncouth than the next guy, how to grow the longest uncombed hair in the class, and how to be a gang leader and raise hell with the police, and how to give a bad time to the old man and to the old lady at home. What happened to these young people? Go ahead and ask yourself. They were just as much of a God-blessed creatures, talented, bright, fine human beings than any other man, just like you. That is, before you and I abandoned those children. That is, before you and I abandoned them, together with the tremendous responsibility that we were not willing to assume, we are not willing to live up to. We thought that it is too much bother in this modern age to raise children. We thought that we are rich and fat, so we can afford to buy character, principle, manner, spiritual strength and morality for those children. And we failed. We failed miserably. And now we are stuck. Of course, we don't want to admit our enormous mistakes, our abandoned responsibility, so we are trying to convince ourselves that the social revolution was coming inevitably. And we are ready to give up the well-proven principles, those which govern this nation for two short centuries of freedom. We are willing to experiment with socialism, which has been failing all over the world, anytime. We are willing to experiment with it on the expense of our freedom, which in turn we are trying to buy with billions of dollars of ransom money around the globe. And we're doing all this with your consent and with your silent agreement. And while we are adopting totalitarian means to be governed at home, the international savages are taking over the world and the darkness is coming closer and closer. We are living in our remote world of everlasting dreams. Our income increased last year. We are buying new homes. We are venturing into new and profitable businesses. And our golf game is improving. The stock market looks pretty good. We are able to provide college education for our children. So what do we care? Ladies and gentlemen, we are painting the cabin while the ship is sinking. Today, only America stands in the way of darkness and hopelessness. We are the only hope of those who are tumbling and crawling in slavery today. We are the only ray of shine in the world today for those who want to keep the light of freedom alive. We are the only nation today who is capable to assume this historical responsibility to keep this earth safe for humanity. Some 200 years ago, our forefathers lighted a torch, the torch of freedom, and had shown and proven to the world that freedom is possible. 200 years ago, it was the future of our nation at stake. But believe me, today it is much more. It is the future of civilization, the future of mankind, the future of our children and grandchildren. It is even more than that. It is our own life. It is our own tomorrows. 100 and a few years ago, Abraham Lincoln said these immortal words: I have been driven many times to my knees by the overwhelming conviction that I have nowhere else to go. Ladies and gentlemen, we don't have any other place to go.
You all know, of course, that one of the founders of the Newport Folk Foundation